once again to Searching for American Gods, an American Gods podcast. I am one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the U.S. of A., and with me in the state of New York.
Hi, this is Mike.
Mike, how's it going?
I'm fine, Phil. How are you?
Doing all right. So what's this podcast about, Mike, for new listeners?
This podcast is called Searching for American Gods. It is about the Starz TV series American Gods, based on the Neil Gaiman novel that was published, about 11 or 12 years ago. And it's in the middle of its second season, actually heading into the end of its second season. There's, I think, only two more episodes left after the episode we discussed tonight.
Yep, that's right. That's right. So we here are critiquing and reviewing each episode of the TV series. And for folks who want to go back, we did all of season one about a year and a half to 2 years ago when that show, or I should say season, was on. And we are back now. When the show goes on hiatus, we go on hiatus. And hopefully we will be here for season three, assuming season three is going to be made. They already said it will be, but based off of the ratings of this season and specifically this last episode that we're going to talk about tonight, whether it's good or not, it was the lowest so far at 0.24 or 240,000 people, at least in North America.
Well, this goes back to something we've talked about before, is not really knowing the economics of how these series work, because now you have things like global streaming, you have streaming on other services, like how many people watch it through the Starz app, how many, there's a Starz service on Amazon, you have things like Roku and Apple TV, what do they make in terms of DVD sales, and then again, what's the international market like? I have no idea what's required for a show like this to turn a profit.
Yeah, exactly. Well, one issue with Starz is that they have a Starz app, but unlike HBO, it's not a standalone. You still have to go through like some sort of cable company or something to use the app, which is unfortunate. Basically, it's like HBO Go, which is the app that you would use if you go through a cable company,
right?
But HBO also has that newer app from 2 years ago called HBO Now, which you can purchase the HBO without going through a cable company. And at this time, Starz only has their version of HBO Go, not their HBO Now. So I think that may hinder some folks as well. And you mentioned, Mike, that even though Starz is a pretty good station, it has a lot of good shows. Compared to HBO, it's fairly smaller, right?
I don't think it has a subscriber base. They have some shows like American Gods, but there are others on it that are original programming, but none of them have ever really gotten the buzz that Sopranos got, or certainly Game of Thrones has, or pull out some Netflix series like House of Cards or Orange is the New Black or Stranger Things. So that's never really raised their profile.
Right.
But, so it's going to be really interesting to see. Again, will there be a third season? Will the budget be further cut? Will the episode order be cut? Will they be losing any more actors along the way? There's going to be a new showrunner. So, I don't know. We'll see. I did notice they just announced because everybody is out there trying to do their own original content, but YouTube has basically announced it's ending its subscription service.
Oh, YouTube is dropping the YouTube subscription service. How about that?
Right. So there's been YouTube Red, and they had some of their own original programming on there, which hasn't caught on. The only one that's come close to catching on, I guess, has been was the Cobra Kai series, which was the spinoff of Karate Kid.
Mm-hmm.
And that got good word of mouth, but I guess not enough people were subscribing. So they're getting out of the market for original programming.
Okay.
And just going back to, I guess, doing what they've been doing all along and streaming videos and getting ad revenue off the videos that they stream.
Well, they also have a YouTube app that is basically similar to Hulu Live or DirecTV Live, which is you get like 80 channels like a cable thing, but you're just going through the internet to do it instead of going through cable.
Right.
So I'm assuming they'll probably keep that because that's not original programming. That's programming from other companies that they allow through their app.
And and HBO was acquired by, I guess, Time Warner. I guess is that still?
Yeah,
AT&T, right. Yeah. And they're basically telling HBO they're not happy with HBO being a Sunday night thing. Right. You know, so they want, and HBO has some really good programming on Sunday night. Obviously, they have Game of Thrones, but they also have things like Veep is airing its final season. There's a new show. I can't think what it's called. But about the former assassin who becomes an actor. I know Eric Webster has talked about it. I'm blanking on the name of that. They have Silicon Valley. But these all are all shows they rotate throughout the year or two-year cycle on Sunday nights. And apparently AT&T has said, nope, you're going to be a year-long thing now. And we want you an everyday thing. And so they're basically forcing HBO to up its production.
Yep.
And we'll see what that ends up doing to the caliber of their shows. Apparently HBO is notorious for buying a lot of properties and never doing anything with them, because they don't know what they're going to want to do something with. So like they buy it and then they sit on it and never actually develop it. So they probably have like the pilots and the scripts and stuff sitting around to develop into a series that they never actually pulled the trigger on. Yes, but how much of it's going to be any good? You know, can they sustain this model? We'll see. This could be the end of an era for HBO, but that could also then open up avenues for other things like Stars maybe to start to break through.
Right. Yeah, HBO, all their executives basically were fired or retired or quit once AT&T came in. And it's like you said, they didn't want to become Netflix, those executives, because they felt that Netflix is like 95% crap and 5% good stuff, while HBO was, in their opinion, you know, closer to 95% good and only 5% crap. And I guess AT&T wants to do something somewhere in the middle where they
right.
have a lot of programs, but hopefully more or better quality than, say, some of the stuff on Netflix, I guess.
Right. But, and I have no personal loyalty to a particular network any more than networks necessarily have loyalty to their viewers. You know, I just want shows that are decent to be on the air, and, you know, however they get there. It's just unfortunate when you get a show that might be decent when people can't find them or they get lost in the shuffle, and that's kind of where we're getting at now with this so-called era of peak TV.
Right.
It's very easy for things to disappear.
It's the truth. It's the truth. And we could say that American Gods is one of those programs. But again, some programs, such as maybe American Gods, are for a niche audience anyway. So it really is curious how TV is now, where they can have shows for a niche audience, yet they either get lost in the shuffle or can't get enough of a fan base to get money to produce them. And a lot of shows just get canceled all the time. Because they're on stations, you know, that we never really heard of. I know the author, Joe Lansdale, had a show, Happen. I forget the two characters' name, but it's Happen, another character that'll, like, go town to town doing adventures type things. And a lot of folks were watching it, at least in the horror writer community. But, of course, after one season, it was canceled, and the channel that it was on was some obscure channel that I never heard of. So,
was it the Applause Network had the.
Yeah. See, there's a channel I never heard of, Applause Network. I've never heard of that one.
Right.
So.
And that's the one that has the Stephen King series.
Mr.
Mercedes.
Yeah.
Right. Hold on. Siri wants to tell me about Stephen King TV series. So, you know, it was a really good series, at least the two seasons that aired. I have no idea if there's going to be a third season or not, but I don't know anybody that watched it.
Right, right, exactly.
So,
yeah, it's one of those things that just, even with the name Stephen King, if it's on a small channel on a weird night and you can't stream it, who knows what happens to it. So, now, for this podcast, CS Searching for American Gods, for folks to find us, obviously some of you have already found us because you're listening to us right now, but you can find us on two RSS feeds, and that can be found on anywhere podcasts are found. So examples, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, and whatnot. The first feed or search you can just search us for is Searching for American Gods, American Gods Podcast. But you also can find us under Dark Discussions Podcast, because Dark Discussions is the umbrella podcast for this podcast. This is really a spinoff of that. DarkDiscussions.com is the website, and Dark Discussions is basically a podcast where me, Mike, and a few other co-hosts, including one that Mike mentioned, Eric Webster, discuss a genre film each week. And what happened was, is we went and did a few spinoffs and decided to do one on this TV show, American Gods. You can also find us on Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group, and you can email us at darkdiscussions@aol.com, and we will read your email on the podcast. Anything else about that, Mike?
No, I think that's about it. Again, join us on the Facebook group for any conversations about any one of our podcasts. We're currently having some discussions about Game of Thrones, which has just returned, and I think that might have something to do with the drop in ratings, because I know there would be like viewing parties that 60 Minutes had a pre-Game of Thrones episode on CBS, and you know, I'm sure that drew in massive ratings for Sunday night, and that might have eaten some of the American Gods audience. But I mean, it doesn't sound like this was a this wasn't a huge drop over the previous couple of weeks. It was a or was it a, huge drop?
Right, right. That's true. Yeah, I mean, it's been fairly steady, but you're right. Actually, a lot of the drop could have been specifically for Game of Thrones, because it was over 300,000 per episode, and then this episode it suddenly dropped down to 240,000. So yeah, we do have.
And I imagine there's a lot of overlap between the two fan bases.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I would agree with that. For example, you and I, we both watch this show, and we both watch Game of Thrones, and we do another podcast about Game of Thrones with Eric Webster called You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, a Game of Thrones podcast, which we recorded that episode last night. Tonight will be its release, probably around 10 or 11 Eastern Standard Time. We do have an email from or a Facebook post by Elizabeth Catherine Gray. So she went to the Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group where we discuss all our podcasts, including Searching for American Gods. And she wrote this about last week's episode. And she goes, thank you for reading my comments on the podcast. Some info on Mother Brigitte. Many voodoo deities are named after Catholic saints. That's because voodoo was illegal even in Haiti for decades. Maman Brigitte's deity is based on her namesake, Saint Brigitte. Funny thing, Brigitte herself is a pagan god. Many Irish refused to stop worshiping her, and the Catholics had to canonize her so they could convert more people. Again, this is Catherine's opinion, and probably based on fact, but I can't verify any of this. So any Catholics who are upset, please do not attack us. There is a lot of information between her and Mad Sweeney that hints at this. They have slept together before. She also hints that it is Mad Sweeney that is in love with Laura. This would make sense if you remember the standalone episode from last season. He loved her grandmother as well. So when Brigitte and Baron Samedi do that sexual switcheroo, they are trying to force their hand. But Laura and Mad Sweeney failed to see what they were trying to do. boy, can smart characters act dumb sometimes.
Yeah.
Listening to the preview show to your Game of Thrones, You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, a Game of Thrones podcast. And so looking forward to this and this season for sure. And then she asked a question about, let's see what it is. A question, it's our fifth interview, and we are also talking Game. Oh, okay. So it's nothing. Sorry. Thank you, Catherine, Elizabeth Catherine Gray. And Mike, who is Elizabeth Catherine Gray? She's a podcaster too, isn't she?
She's a podcaster. I met her at the Scares of Care weekend. I think the second Scares of Care weekend down in Williamsburg, Virginia, the next one of which is the first weekend in August. And we ended up being in the audience for a podcast and struck up a conversation, and that started a friendship. And, you know, we've since kind of kept tabs on each other. We've co-hosted different panels at the Scares of Care weekend ever since, and been Facebook friends, and occasionally made guest appearances on each other's podcasts.
Indeed. And she does, what's her podcast
name? Her podcast is Archivist Bet on Sexy Witches, which I think is just hitting its fifth anniversary. They're starting their new season tonight, I believe. And we'll be probably talking about Game of Thrones, among other things. Obviously, by the time the listeners hear this, that episode would have been recorded, but you can go find them, I imagine, on pretty much any podcast providing service.
Now, are you joining her on her season premiere episode?
I'm going to try.
Gotcha.
I'm not promising, but I'm going to try.
Right. So that'll be exciting. She asked myself, Eric, and Mike of You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, a Game of Thrones podcast, if any of us would like to join her on the episode tonight. And myself and Eric are busy, but you said you were possibly, depending on scheduling, be able to do it. So if not, people should check her show out anyway, but if so, you get an extra treat because Mike may be a guest host on the episode. All right, so let's talk about this episode here for American Gods. Again, it was 240,000 listeners, or I should say viewers. Donor the Great was the name of the title, or is the title of the episode. Rachel Talaway directed it. She actually has directed a number of things in the past, including Tank Girl from 1995. She directed Freddy's Dead, The Final Nightmare.
Oof.
And a couple other films. Most of them I haven't heard of. And the writer for the episode is someone named Adria Lang. And it was aired April 14th, 2019. All right, so let's discuss what we thought about this episode and so forth. So, Mike, why don't you start?
Yeah, so it was an interesting episode. I have some quibbles with it, which I'll get to in a minute. It adds more backstory. It answers a question that I imagine anyone who's familiar with Norse mythology would have, which is, we've got Odin, where the hell is Thor?
We discussed that, I think, last week, right? We said, Why isn't there other Norse gods? Yeah, but go on.
Well, we were supposed to get
Teutonic gods.
Right, well,
yeah.
there was a character in the very first episode in prison who helps out Shadow Moon that's supposed to be Loki, who was supposed to be returning this season, but we haven't seen him yet, to the best of my knowledge. He's the one that tells him to always be nice to the ladies at the airport.
Yep, I remember that.
So I thought that was an interesting backstory. It gives them an out for telling us how the gods can be permanently killed. I'm not sure, again, where it figures in outside of that tidbit of information into the bigger picture. You got to a callback sort of to season one by having Odin and Shadow Moon doing a scam, which was nice to see, and that was a fun little bit. It was okay. It was a nice bit. I think it was maybe one of the stronger episodes for the season. But also, I don't know if it's going to be, you know, one of the most memorable if this series continues. I don't know that would be one of the better episodes of the series either. So we'll see. Yourself?
Yeah, I actually felt, I think, a lot more positive to this episode. For the canon of the two seasons, it's a strange episode, again, because it's almost like a standalone.
It's besides... a bit like the episode they did last year that focused on Mad Sweeney and the Irish girl, right?
The grandmother of, as Elizabeth Catherine Gray said in her note to us, the grandmother of Laura.
Right, is that it's mostly a flashback episode.
Yeah. Yeah, and this one is the same. It's a flashback episode, and it, like you said, it doesn't seem like it answers any real questions about where the story's going. It more was a setup for some backstory telling, I guess, of, we'll get into it when we talk about it. But I actually think I may like this episode the best out of all the episodes of the series so far. And it's probably because of the period piece. It was interesting. And it was just a fun 1 hour episode, even if it doesn't really, at least this point, merge with the series itself as a whole. But as a standalone and someone put this in front of me, I probably would say this was a really good 55 minutes of entertainment. And also it has a nod to the great Lou Reed. So I like this one, this episode a whole lot, I think. I still am trying to decipher what they were trying to get at. I did have to read a few things to figure out who Columbia was. And it was kind of cool that they are using more Germanic names for the gods, because Donar the Great is Thor. Donar is the German name for Thor. And that's why I keep on saying Teutonic now instead of Norse, because Teutonic includes all the Norse countries plus all the Germanic countries.
And it also conveniently avoids any potential arguments with Marvel Studios or confusion with the character of Thor. Obviously, Marvel can't own the name Thor because it pre-exists the comics, but, yes, you know, rights attorneys can really come down on you with a hammer. Just to try to intimidate you or tie you up legally.
Well, they did use the name Thor a few times because Shadow says everybody knows who Thor is.
Right.
You know, so they weren't that timid.
But also, you know, they don't really call Wednesday Odin very much. They're more likely to call him Wotan.
Right.
Than they will Odin. So it is kind of keeping it consistent within the mythology of the series as they've established it so far.
Though he did use his last name and his son's last name as Odin's
son. Yep.
Yeah. So, but you're right. Yeah, they've gone mostly with the Teutonic names rather than the Norse names generally. I mean, Wednesday and Wotan are the Teutonic names of Odin versus Odin, which is the Scandinavian name. Makes sense that they would go consistently and go with Donar instead of Thor. It's funny too, is that Thor is a typical name in a lot of Scandinavian countries to this day. So, I mean, you really can't trademark the name Thor. You know, I mean, the character maybe, but again, like you said, it's a god from a long time ago that people wrote about. Let's see. So, yeah, so there's two sets of stories here. There's the flashback story, and then there's the mall story, right?
Right. And the mall story isn't all that much, right? It's not. It's a moving the pieces a little further down the board, continues the storyline we've been dealing with for a couple of weeks now of Odin trying to get his spear back. We saw him reach a dead end last week by bringing it to North America's tallest dwarf, who says he can't do it because it's not a matter of repairing it. He has to have runes put on the staff, and that needs to be repaired. So he sends them to these other dwarves in whatever random mall in America that they go to, and they say they can't fix it unless they have a magic artifact. And what was that magic artifact that they needed?
It actually was coincidentally in the mall at a memorabilia store, and it was the leather jacket of the late great Lou Reed of the Violent. I'm not the Violent, the Velvet Underground.
And I don't know if we conclusively know whether or not that artifact is in fact magic or not, or it was just something that was in the mall that they wanted and couldn't afford. But I do kind of like the idea that you could still have magic artifacts being made. It makes you wonder, like, what would in fact be, what would qualify as a magic artifact in the modern era, right? What special items might there be? And you could argue.
And what makes Lou Reed's jacket versus, say, the other jackets or clothing that were owned
yeah,
by
as opposed famous, to
yeah,
yeah
like Elton Elvis, John's, right?
Yeah, when Elton John's glasses or Elvis's cape,
right?
Or you know Paul McCartney's bass or whatever it is. There's all sorts of things that you can come up with as a possibility, you know. And you could go to like movie props, like the ruby slippers, you know, or you know. Luke's lightsaber or something like that. There's all sorts of things.
Indiana Jones's whip and hat.
Hat, yeah. There's all sorts of stuff. So, but again, it's the kind of thing where the writer can just make it whatever they want to make it for whatever reason. And I'm assuming he just happens to be a big Lou Reed fan.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point. Because if you're going to choose a famous musician, Lou Reed is famous, but he's a bit more of a cult following person. In other words, if you go up to people and you say, oh, Lou Reed was great, they may not know who you are. But if you say Paul McCartney or John Lennon's great, everybody knows
right.
who you're talking about. So it's curious that they would go with more of a cult person rather than a mainstream person. And also, they do go and talk about his background, young Jewish kid from New York, whatever. Didn't mention anything about the Velvet Underground and Andy Warhol, but maybe that has something to do with it. His angst. They mentioned, you know, drug use and all this other stuff. So I don't know. I mean, it is curious. I have no idea why, but it was kind of a cool moment, similar to say Stephen Stills in Prometheus, you know, that callback moment, or John Denver in Alien Covenant. But again, I still don't know if it had any more significance, except maybe Neil Gaiman, just like Lou Reed.
Right. And it's also nice to kind of call out somebody who is a little bit more obscure than the super famous and therefore a little less obvious
right.
than the super famous.
Yep.
So, but still obviously someone that most of the audience, if they don't know as well as they would know Elvis or McCartney or Elton John, they've heard the name probably, even if they can't necessarily pinpoint exactly how.
Right, right. And even if you haven't heard of Lou Reed, you may have heard of the Velvet Underground too. So
certainly, yeah.
Yeah. For folks who don't know what we're talking about, Lou Reed was one of the lead guitarists and one of the lead singers of a band called the Velvet Underground that had three or four albums. Was good friends with Andy Warhol and played at the factory a lot, and they were pretty damn good. And then he had issues, like a lot of band members do, with some of his co-members, and he went off as a solo act, and he had some success there. His most famous song is a song, I forget the name of it, but everybody would probably know it.
Said, hey, babe, take a walk on the wild side. And the colored girls go do 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 do. Do
But either way, for some reason, this item is magical. I don't know what that meant, except that maybe it gave the dwarf the power to create runes. That's all.
Or he was just bullshitting and they wanted the jacket and didn't have the $7,000 to buy it.
That's true. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, and Odin, stuck that he is, whether he believes them or not, he doesn't let on, and he just goes ahead and gets it, because if that's what I got to do to get my runes.
Yeah, this totally. I know I commented on this on an earlier episode, but this is totally out of your generic video game RPG. You know, where you need to complete a quest to complete a quest to complete a quest. You know, where everyone sends you on these fetch quests.
Yes. Yeah.
You know. Oh. Well, yes, I can fix your spear, but if you want to fix my spear, you have to go get this jacket for me. And then, in order to get this jacket, you have to go get my cat out of a tree. To get the cat out of a tree, you got to go get a fish from the river. You know, just keep going on and on and on, and eventually you just kind of forget exactly why you're on this quest in the first place.
Yeah, yeah, that's actually a good analogy, Mike. Because the first quest was to go to the blacksmith dwarf, who then has him go to the rune dwarf, who then has him go get the quote-unquote magical Lou Reed jacket. And then,
and even before all that, you had to send the genie and Salim off to get the spear in the first place.
Right, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, so yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, and that's the thing that's interesting, is that I think this show, if they had focused at the episode one, how important the spear was and what it can do and all that, I think its significance and these quests would seem more interesting or appropriate, rather than, okay, so he needs the spear. What's that supposed to do? Except, I guess, it's a weapon. So I feel that it would have been kind of cool to make the spear an important thing at the beginning of this season, because obviously it's going to play an important part throughout the next two episodes, I think.
Yeah, I would imagine. This is sometimes a problem the show has, sometimes. It's frequently a problem the show has, where it deliberately withholds information from the audience or plays things a little bit too coyly, at least in my opinion. Where sometimes just giving enough information, they don't hold back, go back to Star Wars, they don't hold back what the Death Star does. They tell you right in the opening crawl it has the power to destroy a planet, and then whatever it is, about 30 minutes, to, 40 minutes into the movie, they show you it destroy a planet, you know, so you understand full well what it is that you're dealing with. Here, telling us why the spear is important, I need my spear back. You know, Odin's spear is not as famous as Thor's hammer. You know, right. Give us just a little bit more information as to why you need it, as to what can it do that makes it irreplaceable.
Yeah, that's a fair point, Mike. I would agree with that. And I think that would have made us understand this mission a little more than the little understanding we really have, except that he wants his famous spear back that he happens to obviously use as some sort of weapon, so... that's as generic as you can get, rather than we're discussing here. Maybe it could have been more of a the Death Star and that, or the nuclear bomb or whatever that could save the day for whoever or whatever.
Well, it's the MacGuffin, right? And you know, the thing that everybody's chasing after in the film, you know, the classic example being the Maltese Falcon in Star Wars. It's the Death Star plans
Indiana Jones.
Spider-Verse, they call it the Goober. Indiana Jones is the Lost Ark. So yeah, it's a thing. So why is? But usually you know what the thing is and why, because you know they tell you the Lost Ark. You know, an army with it is going to be invincible. They know the Death Star blows shit up, and will end the rebellion. And they know that the Maltese Falcon is worth a lot of money, right? So why are we going after this particular spear? What does it allow Odin to do that he otherwise wouldn't be able to do?
Sure. I mean, obviously, if you're familiar with Norse mythology, Teutonic mythology, you may have a general idea of its importance. But again, even its importance has nothing to do with its importance to the show specifically. And I think that's even more important. So even the folks who may know the stories around the spear from Norse mythos in the saga, it may not matter because, again, the show obviously uses the gods in a very odd way, and I'm sure the spear will be as well. So we'll have to see. All right, so is that pretty much it for the Maul experience, or is there more stuff?
Well, there was this the cardinal scam, right? Or was it Bishop? Where they scam the store that has it. And I thought that was pretty well done, where Wednesday comes in dressed up as a Catholic bishop to pay for it. You know, wants to try the jacket on. And while he's got the jacket on, Shadow Moon comes in with the mall security, claiming that he's a con artist and that the bills that he has are counterfeit. You know, and he shows him, you know, so yeah, you use the iodine test. Iodine stains certain things brown. And so it passed the iodine test. He said, well, he paid for the paper, but he shows the ink smudges. And we later see that he actually just had a cheap green ink pad in his possession. So he just got some on his thumb and smeared it on the paper to show that the ink smudged. And so they confiscate the jacket and take back the money, all as evidence, you know, but, you know, leave the guy with a, you know, thank you. Your country thanks you for your service. You know, and the guy's all proud. Of course, it's all bullshit. So they managed to get the $7,000 jacket for free.
Right. Right. And he does question the jacket and where it's going and, you know, can he return it? And they say like we kind of mentioned, it's evidence. And so, he gets a card, obviously a fake card with a fake phone number from a, you know, the fake police department. And, the guy being, a desk jockey, behind the counter basically, buys the whole thing and doesn't, you know, say, oh, I have to call my boss before you take it, even though, you know, you quote unquote are a police officer. So, but yeah, that was a funny little bit. I don't know who those mall cops were unless he conned the mall cops too.
I imagine he came in, he said, I'm with the FBI. I need you to come with me. And they probably bought into it too, because they disappear immediately after that scene.
Exactly. Yeah,
so it was just something to add some authenticity to it. What I like is that it finally gives Shadow Moon something to do that's active. It gives the actor something to do, you know, as he gets to play something other than the perpetually befuddled and frustrated Shadow Moon. You know, he gets an active role in the show, and it's the most we've seen him do for this season, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. It is the most we've seen, probably. But again, yeah, we've discussed, I think, in last episode and maybe the episode prior of Searching for American Gods, our befuddlement over how they are using the Shadow Moon character. As you mentioned, he is supposed to be the main character, and yet he seems to be a secondary character in the TV show, even though he's a main character in the book. And the question is, again, I haven't read the book. You said you haven't. So we don't know if that character in the book is just a perspective character, even though he's the main character, or if it's something more and they're just using the character oddly in the television show and it makes him appear to be a secondary character. I don't know. Okay, so anything else with the real world? I mean, it's kind of interesting how they go back between the real world and the past. Basically, every time Wednesday falls asleep, it's basically, it's almost like he's dreaming about the past. And then, of course, a couple of times he talks to a shadow, because shadow, like, for example, right after they do the fake arrest, Odin still has his handcuffs on, and Shadow says, I want to know more about your son, which is part of the period piece of this episode, and then he begins to talk, and then we go back to that period piece as well. All right, so let's get into the period piece.
Right. Now, I just want to put up front, I have one minor gripe with it, and that seemed to be a very progressive burlesque show for the 1930s, by which I mean you have both white and black dancers on stage. You have whites and blacks in the audience. That Wednesday makes a crack about how Thor or Donar is not just popular with the ladies, and the audience laughs, implying, of course, that he's popular with some of the gentlemen as well. And it seems really out of place for a 1930s show.
Okay, that's a fair point. Absolutely.
And this isn't something like, now we talked about the movie Overlord that came out last October or November.
Yeah, it was one of our episodes of Dark Discussions podcast, as a matter of fact.
Right, where they have a black soldier in the with the airborne forces, and that did not happen in World War II. But that's at least a fantasy film. That was a strict fantasy, and they weren't making race an issue, so I could kind of ignore it for that. Here, this is a show that has made such a big issue out of race and segregation and racial history in the United States that it's really weird that they would do that and not necessarily address it within the show.
Yeah, that's a good point, because even Nancy... what's his name?
Mr. Nancy.
Yeah, Mr. Nancy plays a effeminate stage show person in the episode as well, which I could kind of believe. But now that you put it in perspective, would they have a African American person, gay or not, be in the back room where white women are changing continuously back in 1930 when, you know, we had the Crow laws and all that stuff. So,
well, at the very least, well, the Jim Crow laws were mostly in the South. I don't know, because this was supposed to be set in Chicago.
Okay. Well, the typical bigotry of the time era.
Right. But at the very least, he was behind the scenes, right? And there were people, you know, they maybe not have been, personally might not have an issue with it, but recognize that they would have larger issues with the community. So even if you weren't necessarily thought of yourself as a racist or had a problem with blacks, you know that you could be ostracized or shunned by the, you know, quote unquote polite community or nice society, if they found out that you were dealing with blacks or minorities or homosexuals, and that could ruin your reputation. It can ruin your business. Yeah, but at least he was behind the scenes. He was backstage. He wasn't out front. So that, I think, might be a little bit more plausible.
Mm-hmm.
And we never have any idea, like, who the dancers are. Are they just normal people? We know that there's at least two gods that are on the stage.
Right.
Well, three if you count Wednesday. You know,
right.
So who knows?
And four if you want to count Nancy in the back.
Right. So we don't know, are these dancers just, like, Valkyries, are they minor gods or deities that are looking for a job, just something to get themselves some attention? That I have no idea. So that could explain why nobody would take issue of the black guy in the back. But it's more the audience. You know, why does the audience not have a problem with a black women on stage? Why does the audience have no problem with black people in the audience, or with Mr. Nancy, with Wednesday, you're making what seems to me a very overt reference to people of a different sexuality, back in the 1930s.
Yeah, see, I mean, the only explanation of that phrase to make it at least fit in the time period that it came out would be the more well-known line, when they say things about Brad Pitt, for example, where they say every woman wants to be with him and every man wants to be him.
Right.
And if it was meant in that way, where all the women want to be with Thor because, you know, he's Oshkosh and whatever, and all the men want to be Thor because he can
talk to ladies. Yeah, that might be it.
You know, that's the only thing I can think of that would make it fit. at that time period.
But there's also, and there's also, let's remember that even up through the time he died, people didn't realize Liberace was gay.
Right.
You know, not like in denial, like just flat out didn't even occur to them that he might be gay.
Yeah, never mind. People like Rock Hudson, which wasn't effeminate like Liberace.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, because it just was such a where it's harder to understand now because it's so much more out in the open.
Right.
That you could at least recognize the possibility. It's where you get somebody as flamboyant and, you know, but like you mentioned, was it North by Northwest where one of the hitmen was coded as gay, but they,
yeah, Martin Lando.
Right. But they had to be completely coded and you had to be looking for it to pick it up.
Right.
It wasn't sort of an obvious thing.
Right. His character. Absolutely. Yeah. That's, shows you the screenwriting and direction of Alfred Hitchcock in the 1950s and 60s, where he was able to hide sexuality, heterosexuality, never mind, like you mentioned here, the gay character in North by Northwest.
Oh, right, yeah.
But here it's obviously blatant. You know, it's 2019. They don't have to worry about that coding that Hitchcock had to go through. But again, as you mentioned, it wouldn't fit in that time era anyway in a club like that, unless it was a segregated club, whether it was all black or all white. But the way it was put together,
well, I don't know the history well enough to say that there was or was not. I just, yeah, yeah. It seems weird that it was never even brought up or mentioned, because it's not like Chicago was free of racial tensions in the 1930s. But anyway, but it also wouldn't have been that important to the story. It's just that they've made such an intro out of it, out of so many other episodes, the idea that would be completely glossed over here seems a little weird to me, especially since there was no reason for them to necessarily put two black dancers in the show. There was no reason for them to have to put black actors or black people in the audience either. Yeah, so that was a deliberate choice on the part of the people making the show.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. So the question is, is this just Wednesday's dream, how they're doing it, or are they just trying to be politically correct in a time that wasn't politically correct?
Yeah, I don't know. I also. So anyway, the idea is that here at this, it's a burlesque show. You see Wednesday put on a show and a song and dance, which was nice.
Yeah.
Which was a nice little setup and gives Ian McShane something else to do besides just playing Wednesday as his normal self. But the stars of the show are Columbia, who is the goddess of the Americas, basically. She was like symbolized the Americas up until, and one of the points is that she's been replaced by Miss Liberty, the Roman goddess Libertas. And so her power is waning. And of course the other one is Donna or Thor, who is the strong man of the show, and we get to see him do his stuff, and which was a fun little bit. And if you have any fondness for old shows like that, vaudevillian or burlesque shows, it's, you know, variety shows, it's kind of fun to watch those for themselves, let alone their larger part in the story.
Oh, and the costume design, too.
Oh, and the costumes were good. The music was good.
I was just waiting for the gangster to come in, you know?
Yeah. Well, and then they do, but they're not gangsters. They're Nazis.
Right.
And I like the fact that Odin doesn't care that they're Nazis, right? He's willing to make a deal with them. And to me, that makes sense, right? Not because he necessarily has any affinity for Nazi ideology, but here's a character who's lived for thousands of years or hundreds of years. This is just one more mundane political movement that will, and as you know, basically die out sooner or later. What does he care?
Now, let me ask you this: when did this flashback supposed to be exactly? Because if it was before Crystal Knight, then I could see anybody and everybody just assuming that the Nazis are just another tin-bit dictator like Lenin. And in the Soviet Union, which he was pretty bad too, but, or even the smaller dictators that were in Poland and Albania and whatnot back in that time frame in the 1930s.
I don't know. There were certainly people in the United States who had no trouble with what they believed was going on in Europe. You know, people forget that we know about like the Holocaust now. We didn't necessarily know what was going on or the extent to what was going on.
At the time. And that's why I was curious if this was before or after Kristallnacht, because if once Kristallnacht happened, that's pretty much when it was overt racism or, you know, anti-Semitism and all that in Germany itself. Prior to that, even when the Germans were in power before Kristallnacht, it was just another dirtbag political party like the communists or any other dirtbag political party.
Yeah, but you also had in the United States at the time, coming off of obviously this is probably more than a decade later, but you know the Klan had a resurrection because of the release of Birth of a Nation. You know, it's not like racism wasn't what it is now in the United States, where you know it's just immediately assumed to be bad. So you certainly had plenty of it in the United States at the time. So even that wasn't necessarily a horrible thing. I'm sure this is probably still in the time when like Harvard had strict limits on how many Jews they would be willing to accept into Harvard University, you know. So sort of how like they have issues now with admitting Asians.
Right. Oh, my God. Yeah.
Yeah. So so even that, I don't think, because we weren't involved in the war. Yes, there were people opposed to it. There were people who wanted to stay out of it, some because they maybe believed or supported the Nazis, but more often I think it was because they just got out of, relatively speaking, within living memory, World War I and really had no desire to get back involved in this shit again.
Right. Well, and you got to remember, I mean, before Kristallnacht, which was in 1938, and the war itself, Germany actually held the Olympics. It meaning, even though the Nazis were in power, they were still considered at that time, prior to Kristallnacht, a legitimate government in a sense, similar to what I guess China Iran or Cuba is right now.
Right, but I don't think they ever give us the date. I don't think they give us an exact date. Just clearly the 1930s, because it's clearly before 1941. It's clearly before we're in the war.
That's true. Yeah,
and it's also clearly, you know, while the Nazis are in power. So yes, it's got to be sometime in the 1930s. So let's probably ballpark and say like 35, somewhere around there.
Yeah. That would be pretty good, because they are prominent enough by that point to be known worldwide. And then they are not post-Kristallnacht yet, where anybody who said Nazis are good would be immediately considered a traitor. So I agree. That sounds like an excellent point to say around, what, 35, you said?
Yeah, let's see, a ballpark, right?
Yeah,
so 35, 36.
Yeah. Yeah, because I'm looking here. He became, meaning Hitler, became chancellor in 1933. So it would be anywhere from 33 to 38. This has to take place.
Probably
around 35, because they get prominence by an international prominence by the mid 30s, and then they all go downhill in 38 when they became overt racists and anti-Semites. So at this point, someone could get away with being, I guess, pro-German at that time in the 30s. And so it, in other words, when the German guy, the American that is of the German Nazi, I mean, the American Nazi Party comes in wearing the swastika, no one gives two winks. No one's concerned like, oh my God, it's a Nazi. So obviously what you said, which is bad things hadn't happened yet to make the Nazis be considered what they are, known of for today.
Right. So what the Nazis want is to recruit Thor Donar to be their representative in like the American strongman competition.
Oh, one of the best is when they say, what's his last name? And he goes, I don't have a last name. And then Odin goes, it's Odinson. And the guy goes, oh, is that Finnish? And Odin just goes, no, don't worry about it. It's kind of funny. But anyway, continue, Mike. I'm sorry.
So, right. And Odin is perfectly amenable to this because, again, he doesn't care about the Nazis. And why would he? He's not involved in mortal affairs. All he wants is war. As a war god, it helps him. And getting followers. And, hey, he can elevate the whole pantheon, right? Is that he can bring all the Norse gods or Teutonic gods up if he becomes famous in the United States as being like the, you know, America's great strongman.
Right, because they want him to basically do the Arnold Schwarzenegger, Mickey Haggerty strongman back in the 30s. You know, in other words, whatever Mr. Universe. They wanted him to compete basically for Mr. Universe and weightlifting and Olympics and all that. And if he becomes famous, like you said, Mike, the whole pantheon of Teutonic gods could ride the wave of Donar or Thor. And suddenly you have worshippers, not necessarily worshiping them as gods, but worshiping them as heroes for the United States. And then that is enough to make the gods become powerful, at least based off of how the show works anyway.
Right. So Columbia is Donar's girlfriend. Right. She wants to run off to California where they, you know, maybe they can become stars, which is a little weird because Columbia Pictures was a thing at the time. But you couldn't really get the Nazis involved if you said this before. I was just looked it up. Columbia Pictures was founded in 1924. You think that would have given her some cachet. That seems like the kind of thing she would sell out to, right? Is to be one of the new gods.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. Yep. Well, that's, I mean, going to Hollywood is what she wants to do. That's basically the modern gods, right?
Right. And Wednesday convinces Thor to do, or Donar to do the strongman competition instead. Donar makes it to the finals, and the Germans want him to throw the match
You mean the American Nazis?
I'm sorry, the American Nazis, thank you. Want him to throw the match so that way the Germans can win. And he wants to leave. He doesn't want he's had it, he's not gonna do that. And he plans to run off with Columbia. And Odin steps in, tells Columbia.
Well, we forgot Nancy too, right? Because Nancy kinda pushes him a certain way.
Right.
But
Nancy tells a bit of his own story, which is that he, you know, when he was first created, he was, you know, one of the first male gods, and he left his homeland and told wherever he went, he had told those people about where he came from, and those people went back and destroyed the place where he came from, and therefore most of the female gods there as well. So,
right, because it was a matriarch society.
Right.
And even though he was favored by his mother, he would never be able to lead the society or the gods in that era because of the matriarch's way. So he heads to the future, because he's a god, he has powers to do so, to find a spot where he could be powerful as a male. And then, like you stated, he does that, and then the people he meets somehow have powers too. The gods that he meets in the future all go back and wipe out where he came from, basically.
But it's the idea that sometimes people don't think through their actions all the way, you know, so why would they want him to throw it? And I kind of take it as they don't realize what they're playing with when they're playing with the Nazis.
Right.
And so Odin meddles, and he convinces Columbia that Thor's gone off to compete in the competition. And then he goes to Donar and convinces him that Columbia's run off to go to Hollywood. And so lies to the two of them till he can get what he wants. Because really, I think one of the main points of this story is that, if you didn't already know it, that Odin is a snake. You know, Mr. Wednesday is somebody who will lie and hustle because the only thing he cares about is getting his followers, getting his worshippers, getting his power. And he betrays, you know, two of his allies in order to do it. And that really should be a warning to Shadow Moon.
Right. But of course, Shadow Moon doesn't know this, right? Because I have no idea if when he's telling the story, is he telling it that way?
Yeah, I don't know. It's at the very least it warns the audience.
Right, right.
And we go there because he does say something about how Shadow Moon reminds him of his son. You know, meaning Donna or Thor, and that he has died the permanent death, and Shadow Moon's trying to get out of him how exactly does a god die a permanent death, which again is another, finally Shadow Moon asks a question, doesn't get just get brushed off, as he finally gets Odin to tell him, and finally we learn that several years later
in Philadelphia
that he commits suicide.
Thor commits suicide. Yeah, we don't know the reasons. We can assume that it's because his life collapsed because he loses his girlfriend. He was probably somehow kicked out of the. Oh no, he quit the competition because he didn't want to throw the fight or the weightlifting.
Right.
And so he suddenly now. And then he loses his father's love in a sense. So now he's like this. You know, pitiful first individual,
and,
right?
And it's also now in the war effort, you notice you have the picture of Rosie the Riveter in the back.
Yeah.
And we had seen Columbia being, this is the first chronological period that we see the technical boy.
Yeah.
Yeah,
the telephone, right?
Right, with the telephone and other things. And he's basically there recruiting Columbia. And I think the implication might be that Columbia becomes Rosie the Riveter.
That's my guess, yeah.
You know, and so she's found a new place in American society as a different kind of icon.
Yeah.
And he's alone, and, you know, was it 1941, 1942? So he certainly sees what the Nazis are doing, that he was helping out in the first place. And for whatever reason, he chooses to commit suicide, and I guess that's the only way that the gods can die is by their own hand, permanently.
Right, exactly. Suicide is the only way they can die without being resurrected another time. Obviously, by bringing in American Nazis, even if the characters involved would be clueless, or at least a percentage clueless until 1938, after Kristallnacht. It's still enough for us, the audience, who already know what the Nazis are, to know that they're bad news. So when you have Odin not caring about the Nazis, you could argue that is a big plot device for the audience to sour on. One of the most colorful and fun characters in the show, even if he's amoral in a sense.
Right. And I'm sure that this is mentioned for a reason that we are probably going to, whether it's going to be this season or next, you know, it's important that they drop this piece of information, that this is a way for the gods to die is by their own hand. And that this is probably going to foreshadow someone.
Right.
Someone committing suicide, whether that's going to be, you know, Wednesday or Nancy or Bilquis, you know, or any of the others, you know, that we know.
Right. One other thing that's interesting about the Nazi, American Nazis, is to give the benefit of the doubt to the characters, meaning the gods that are involved in this episode. When the American Nazi comes in and he has the swastika on, The gods don't even call it a swastika. They call it some other thing. And they're asking, why would you wear that? It doesn't make any sense. In other words, they have no idea who or what the Nazis are, except that it's some group.
Right. Columbia knows, right?
She knows, but the other two don't. They just look at the symbol as some ancient symbol in some culture, and they have no idea that it's now going to represent something else altogether differently.
Right. And again, that works for me. You know, it's a different thing that they didn't because it's something different, because the gods would never really get involved in that kind of arena. You know, they why would they care? Because, you know, one political party will come and go, you know, and certainly they've lived through things that were you know, the Nazis. It's pretty bad. Well, what were the Nazi beliefs fundamentally? You know, were they all that different than some of the various beliefs other people had had? It's the idea that they were bringing back some bad beliefs that had gone away. But look at the centuries that the gods had lived through. They'd probably seen as bad, if not worse. And it was, you know, what they did as much as what they believed that really made the Nazis, right?
Right. Yeah, and that's absolutely true. Absolutely true. Now, the thing that was interesting about that suicide thing was it kind of contradicts one episode from last season. And again, that was the episode that I think made Neil Gaiman say, you know, basically fire, have the original showrunners fired, which is the Vulcan episode. Because Vulcan doesn't appear in the book, supposedly, and they bring him in, and he gets killed or murdered. But he didn't suicide. So technically, couldn't Vulcan come back and get his vengeance? But of course, none of that's going to happen, because that was all made up by the original showrunners. And oddly, because of that, it kind of contradicts or made me think, well, why can't Vulcan come back and throw a wrench in everything? Because it's not in the book, probably. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't know if that's what got him fired. There were a lot of things that probably got him fired. You had the cost overruns. You had, in addition to the differences in creative vision.
Well, the thing that pissed Neil Gaiman off, obviously, the money.
And I don't know. Yeah, but yeah. I don't know if it was in that episode specifically. You know, it's a lot But I would say we don't yet know how all this works. We know that someone dies, they can come back. We know that media comes back, but that was an intentional recreation.
Right.
She deliberately reinvents herself.
And she was, and either so, she wasn't. She didn't suicide, right?
Right. So here, Vulcan or Zaria, when they die, we don't know. Maybe Vulcan can come back, but we don't know if it takes, you know, years or decades for that to happen.
Right.
You know, we don't know how long it takes, or how long, if you do come back, for you to necessarily even realize that you are a god. You know, are they born with all that knowledge, or is it a matter of you have to discover it yourself?
Right.
So yeah, you know, I could see it. I could see, you know, that the problems that Vulcan is might be a piece taken off the board for the foreseeable future.
Yeah.
You know, but may come back. You know, same thing with Argus from a couple episodes ago. It may take them years to get back.
Yeah, that's a good point too, because Argus was another one that was assassinated. Yeah, but and died, but didn't suicide. Yeah, so that's a good point. So the question is, what was this whole backstory about? To be honest, because obviously we already know that gods can reinvent themselves. So, What's the boy's name again? Something boy. What's his name?
Technical boy.
Technical boy. We know he can reinvent himself because he changes from the telephone to whatever the next thing in communication is to make him, you know, stay powerful. And we see what Columbia can do, which is she, from representing a specific thing about the United States, she joins the war effort and becomes the Riveter. But, and in a sense, feminism too, I guess you'd say. But the thing is we already knew that. We already knew that the gods could, you know, cling on to something new and get new followers, even though that's not their original purpose. So that can't be what they were trying to say with this story. And the suicide thing didn't feel big enough to be a whole episode on to say, oh, gods can suicide and that's the reason they're dead forever. So there had to be something else.
Well, I would think it's something to let the audience know that this is a thing that can happen.
But couldn't they have just said that in passing without actually, or when Zora dies, saying, oh, she'll be back, well, because she didn't suicide. It's just that we don't know when. And then Shadow could have said, What do you mean suicide? Oh, that if you suicide as a god, you're dead. So, but instead they do a whole episode on it to just get to the very end to say, if you suicide, you're dead. So
but it also gives some backstory to Odin. It answers the question of where Thor has been. Because I imagine, you know, most people knowing Odin, you want to know what's going on with Thor.
Sure.
And quite frankly, this is, for better or worse, a hallmark of this TV series, which is to take a story or something that you could have dropped in 5 minutes of screen time and drag it out into an entire episode.
Right, right. Yeah, that's a good point. Because even Thor's suicide, because he could have said in another episode, yeah, my son died, he suicided, that's why you don't see him anymore, what are you going to do? And, you know, make a joke moment out of it, like a lot of this show is kind of an allegory anyway. So, but you're right. I mean, and it could have been more to, you know, build people's backstories and whatnot.
Right. We also get some of Mr. Nancy's backstory. We get Odin's backstory. Who knows if we're going to end up seeing more of Columbia now going down the road.
Yep.
We might get some sense of why Odin is taking a liking in Shadow Moon, because it does remind him of his son. Odin may feel some remorse over pushing his son into a position that eventually he kills himself. You know, so he does seem to have some regret about that. It doesn't seem to change who he is, but right. He does seem to have regret over doing something that causes it.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Now, I was just thinking, based off of our discussion of these gods in the flashback, and we mentioned Technical Boy was there. But it's kind of strange because Technical Boy's there, but didn't we just learn in last episode, I think it was, that Technical Boy was created in the 1970s?
Yeah, I don't know. I assumed that. They didn't actually say that. We see the Technical Boy appear. Mm-hmm. So I'm not really sure what to think about that.
Yeah, it is an unanswered question now, because we were assuming, based off of that episode where the technical genius side story we had a couple of episodes ago, where it appeared that Technical Boy was created by that guy, in a sense, and that's why Technical Boy went back to him, was to try to get him to help and get him back to, you know, whatever. But now we're seeing Technical Boy in the 1930s, so I'm just not sure on that. Unless this is another reincarnation. But again, this is a lot of things that aren't answered or shown to us that may contradict, yet may not, if you really want to, you know, discuss it like we're doing now. But it still leaves a lot of things open-ended, in a sense.
Right. And, you know, I was thinking about that episode. You know, one of the, I think, the points of that episode was that the computer programmer was able to recreate Bach's music without Bach. Right?
Right.
It's still a different type of creative genius needed to do that, to come up with a program that can do something like that. But, you know, that was kind of, I think, part of the point of that episode, because now with new media, you can have new media there and bypass the technology. You don't need the Technical Boy anymore.
Yeah.
That he, you know, just as Bach became redundant, so, you know, you can make the programs that weed out the people, therefore you can write something that weeds out the technology that allowed her to function in the first place. And I think with Technical Boy, maybe just as media reincarnates herself depending on the media, I guess you can maybe perhaps Technical Boy was being constantly reinvented as you got new technology coming around time and again.
Well,
over the years.
And they kind of allude to that, I guess, which is fair by the writers of the show and the runner of the show, because when Odin's talking to Technical Boy in the club, the nightclub, burlesque club, he passes over the phone. He says, there's a phone call for you. And then he talks about how in the future the phone's going to be gone. And when it's gone, you're going to lose your power. So you're going to have to evolve like the rest of us. And obviously, we've seen him evolve because we've seen season one. But that can kind of maybe explain how he reinvents himself. The only thing I guess it doesn't explain is, was he, who he was, if the Asian guy, the technical genius guy, actually created Technical Boy or not. And it appears, I guess, he didn't. If anything, he just recreated him, similar to New Media was recreated, the same individual, even though she looks different. But in this case, they're just using the same actor for both identities of Technical Boy, the old one and the new one, maybe?
Yeah, probably. I don't know. Yeah. This is part of the problem of the show being this cryptic and vague, is that you reach for answers that may not be the right answers.
Indeed. So what did you think about the New Gods scenes? There's a few of them. Where we see New Media, we see Mr. World, we see Mr. World's the old guy that does his bidding. What did you think of those scenes?
I didn't think much of them, to be honest with you. It just seemed more to have them there to remind the audience that they're there. I don't know. I didn't feel like it did anything to necessarily move the story along, but I might have missed something.
Yeah.
What were you thinking?
That's what I'm thinking, too, that I might have missed something, because he calls New Media, and she appears, and she does her J-pop and video game and anime skit. And then he asks her if she could do something that would make more powerful, whatever that is. And then she starts speaking what I'm assuming is Japanese, even though I believe the actress that's playing her is a Korean-American. So what happens is it's like a casino sound appears, and all this stuff starts coming out, like all the little Pokemans and all that stuff starts
coming out.
She does
something. Yeah, she does something to get herself more followers, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And that's pretty much it, right? I mean, that was really the whole New God thing, right? Which is maybe he's finding a way. Mr. World is finding a way to, how do we create more followers? And New Media is doing it for him or something. I don't know. So, but I did like the scenes. I love this New Media. I love the character. It's entertaining. Let's see, anything else that we wanted to talk about? Any specific scenes or any more information about the mall, the flashback scene, or I guess the new gods, even though we pretty much just went through that.
No, I mean, that was about it. I think this was, weirdly enough, after complaining about the show being kind of vague, I think this was one of the more straightforward episodes that they've done.
Yeah.
I maybe that's part of the reason why it was more of an entertaining episode. They've only got two episodes left in the season, so they mention with Mr. World that the timetable has been moved up. That Odin got his spear sooner than they expected. So, you know, the assumption then is that they have to, that this conflict is going to be coming earlier than planned. And, you know, that they've been talking about this conflict now for two seasons. Something has to break, right? Something has to happen in the next two episodes to justify all of this buildup.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I agree. I mean, obviously now he has his spear. I'm assuming it's in working condition now. And we, like you said, we only have two episodes left. You would hope, like for example, one of the great things about Game of Thrones, even though each episode is fairly strong, even the quote-unquote weaker ones, they do have a handful of episodes during each season that are hugely memorable because some major thing occurs, whether it's the purple wedding, the red wedding, the wall, Blackwater, Helm Home, or whatnot. This show doesn't seem to have many of those moments, even in season one. We felt maybe at the end, you know, the season finale when Easter did her bit, you know, that was kind of dramatic. And then it you know, then you get the cliffhanger, and then when we come back, it's gone and forgotten. And now we've had six episodes of basically people traveling to for a specific, you know, doing the video game quest where Lara's trying to get a way to become alive again. The leprechaun is trying to get the coin again. The djinn and Shadow and Wednesday are all trying to get his spear again. And then now we have two episodes left. Are we going to have a dramatic moment like, say, we would in Game of Thrones? Or is it going to be another one of those unfortunate instances like last season's cliffhanger, which didn't play at all in season two? So we'll have to see what's going on there. What do you think is going to happen? Do you have any idea, based off of what we've seen these first six episodes, what's going to happen in episode seven and specifically episode eight?
No, not really, because this is one of the frustrating things with the show is that I really don't have any idea where it's going. You know, again, you can bring out Game of Thrones or, you know, as a series that I could see almost anything happening on that show. But we have a good idea of what's going to happen, if not exactly how it's going to play out and when. I could see almost anything happening in the show, but it's because I really have no idea where they're going with it. You know, that there's supposed to be a conflict with the gods, but they've gone at such a leisurely pace that who knows if they're going to get to that conflict this year. Last year, they kept talking about having to meet up at, you know, at the house that they met at the beginning of the season. So you at least had a place they were going, but they were doing an awful lot of wandering along the way. But it was clear that, well, we have to pick up the gods along the way. We have to recruit allies, and we still had an idea where they were going. Here we know that Odin had to get his spear back. Well, he got his spear back. It took him a long time, but he finally got the spear back. We know that Laura had to go back to being alive again, and now we know she needs to get, what was it, the two
the blood
drops
of a lover or something
of a lover or something along those lines. And so that's clearly going to factor into it in this season. But, you know, are we ever going to find out why Wednesday is interested in Shadow Moon this season? You know, are we going to find out what's special about him? Is Laura Moon going to successfully bring herself back? In which case, what is the point of her story after this season? They need to have a reason to keep her around. We were supposed to see other gods come back, you know, and most of the gods disappeared after the second episode and haven't returned. I really have no idea where they're going with this, and that's not necessarily in a good way. Because it's just they're just being overly leisurely about it.
Sure, sure. And that's the thing, is that if we were playing a video game doing that, it may be interesting, but for a TV show that's eight episodes a season, it may not be. For example, me and Mike just did an episode on Dark Discussions with our co-hosts on the new release of Pet Sematary. And me and co-host Eric were discussing how that could have been a mini series in our opinion. And you said, no, you didn't really need to. And then I brought up this show here, American Gods. And I said, it's kind of odd how a book that's smaller than Pet Sematary, even if it has a lot more characters, is going to be a three season show. And yet maybe they may have not needed to be three seasons if, you know, like what we've seen here, and at least especially in episodes two and three, where it was just moving from A to Z, in a sense, right?
Right. There's a lot of series that get books that have been turned into TV series, but they're things that are, you know, it was a crime novel. And though so you just keep the detective characters and just have them investigating a new crime every episode or every season. Pet Sematary is a relatively intimate book. It's about a handful of characters. This at least has the potential to have a very broad scope, you know, has lots of characters from both from the book and outside the book. If you want to bring in, you know, different gods besides the ones that the novel mentions that you can explore, and you have all of human history to explore with this, you know, so I can understand that, but you know, it's clearly suffering for the, I think, for its pacing, you know, for the fact that, you know, a book has beginning, middle, and ending, and I don't know where they're going with this, right? This isn't, they told the story of the book, and now they're going into new places with these characters. You know, and the story of American Gods has had a sequel, and it has had spin-offs and short stories and comics, so it has an expanded storyline. You know, the most you could do with something like Pet Sematary, I think, would be giving it, you know, the Salem's Lot treatment, where they turn that into a two-night miniseries. But even when you cut it, all the commercials out, it's really the length of a long film.
Right.
You know, I think you could have turned Pet Sematary into a 2.5-hour movie, and I think that would have sufficed. But if you wanted to get all the stuff in there. Here, there is more, but it's just, I think they might have, it's sort of like The Stand, you know, The Stand, I think, you know, you could maybe turn into its own series, but you could really run the risk of getting bogged down into side stories and things. And, you know, Walking Dead is a good example where they have a plot to follow with those comics, but they don't want to run out of material. So they kept coming up with ways to stretch storylines out, and that killed, you know, any momentum that they were having.
Right. Well, yeah, there was an episode of Walking Dead, because I was going to bring that up, Mike, and I'm glad that you brought it up, too. They have a lot of these standalone episodes. Like, for example, who's the blonde, the short-haired woman?
Carol?
Carol. And then the black guy that...
Ezekiel?
Yeah, the guy from the very beginning, the black guy from the beginning.
That Morgan?
No, the other black guy. Was it Ezekiel?
No, that died?
Yeah, that died.
Tyrese?
Yeah, that guy. Yeah. Yeah. So he and Carol are at this house in the middle of nowhere with these two little girls. And that episode I liked a lot, but it really didn't move the plot forward. It's just basically one of the little girls was a sociopath. And so.
Right.
You know, but it was a good episode, even if it didn't move the plot.
But that also happened at a point where there was no plot to move forward, where basically the story was that their previous sanctuary had been destroyed and everybody was scattered. There was no larger overarching story arc pushing
right.
that you had to get to. It was these characters have been separated and they're all kind of wandering around. You know they're going to meet up again eventually, but they allowed them each to focus on a different episode to kind of focus on a different groups of characters. You know, as opposed to, you know, what they were dealing with in the more recent seasons where they had the Negan story arc where, you know, they just stretched it out for 2.5 years when they really could have done the whole thing in probably half that amount of time.
Right. Which is kind of weird that they did that, because if they were going to extend that, they could have the cannibal guys, they could have extended that for a whole season. And I think they only used that for what, 3 or 4 episodes.
And even that was only like 1 or 2 issues of the comic, which really meant it, you know, would have been about an episode, but it was, you know, at some point that ends up, that was I think that's a fault of the showrunner. And it kind of came around to bite him in the ass, and they've done a much better job with pacing in this last season, but they haven't done much to get any viewers back because too many people felt burned from before.
Right, right. And it is one of those shows that if you quit the show and you come back a year later, you're going to be completely lost, because it's like, who's this character? And
right.
What happened to that character? And why are they in Georgia instead of Tennessee or wherever the hell they are? So, yeah, because a certain shows... Like the show back in the day, you know, you could watch like Fantasy Island and every episode was a standalone, even though it has the same characters, so that you're never going to get lost. Or the one that Jane Mansfield's daughter's in, Haggerty, I forget her first name, Mariska Haggerty. That's another one with Ice-T where they could just do.
SVU's Law and Order?
Yeah, that show. So, you know, those shows can do it and you can just jump in any day of the week or, you know, any week during the year to watch the show, and you're not going to be lost because they're kind of standalone. But Walking Dead or American Gods, for that matter, if you quit the show, like you said, they're not going to come back because they're going to have to binge watch everything before, probably.
Right. And even something like MASH. MASH had a big shakeup on the cast, but it happened over about a 2-year period.
Right.
So... where they got rid of Frank Burns and they got rid of Colonel Blake, and they got rid of
Radar.
They got rid of Trapper. Well, Radar was a little bit later, but those were 3 main characters that they wrote out of the show, but they wrote them out of the show in very short order, replaced them with duplicates. And so basically you have two eras of the show with a little bit of a transition in between.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So that's a thing is like, yeah, if they drag along like Walking Dead, you lose your viewership. And even if it's still a pretty good viewership, it's lower than it was before. They can improve, but the people who felt burnt aren't going to come back because they felt burnt, or they're going to say, I'm going to have no idea where the show is because I haven't been following it.
And that's the danger with American Gods. A lot of people have feel burnt on the changes to the show since you got rid of the old showrunners and you got to the new season. And I don't know that you're ever going to bring those viewers back.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, and so I think the show's gotten stronger. I think it fumbled the first couple of episodes. I think it's gotten stronger, but it still has a lot of the problems that have plagued the show from the beginning. You know, but it doesn't have quite the same visual panache that it used to, and didn't have it has the problems with the substance, and it doesn't have quite the same style. And sometimes style can do a lot to make up for a lack of substance. But when you start to lose both, that's when you're going to lose your audience.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. So even though me and you are still here, and some of our listeners have probably listened to the show from the very beginning because they are fans of the book, and so they jumped on and watched the show. But there may be some people who never returned to our podcast either because they haven't returned to the show. But we do thank everybody who's still with us, whether they watch the show or not. Hopefully we are talking or giving opinions and critiquing and making observations that you, the listeners, are glad to hear. So,
And if you have your own opinions, please feel free to shoot us an email at darkdiscussions@AOL.com or stop by the message boards on the Facebook group. Excuse me, just search for Dark Discussions on Facebook.com, and we're the only one that'll answer to that.
Yep, absolutely. A couple other things. If you want to meet the co-host of this show here, we're going to be at a couple of conventions in a podcast meetup as well this summer. We're going to be at ScareCon, which is, I believe, the weekend of June 5th. June 6th of this year. So we'll be there, and we'll have a table there.
It's June 7th, 8th, 9th.
Ah, there you go. 7th, 8th, and 9th. We'll have a table there, and you can meet us, talk to us, discuss all things searching for all things American Gods. We're going to be the last weekend of July. We will be at Mystic, Connecticut for a podcast meetup where myself and Mike will meet up with a number of other people on the Dark Discussions podcast network, as well as some of our listeners, to eat Mystic pizza and actually go see a movie and review the movie on the Dark Discussions podcast. And then me and Mike will be at Scares That Care, which is the first weekend of August. And we will not have a table, but we will be doing podcasts, as you said, Mike, with Elizabeth Catherine Gray. Maybe we'll have our own podcast with you, me, and Anthony Thurber of Anthony T's Horror Show, which is also on the Dark Discussions podcast network. And we will be there to meet and greet and so forth. Anything to add to that, Mike?
No. If you can make it to any or all of those, that would be fantastic. We always like hearing feedback, so we know that we're not just talking into the ether. To help out Technical Boy and New Media. So we always like to hear from our listeners. We often read messages we get on the air, if you'd like that, because neither one of us is sitting here from a position of authority saying this is what this means, this is how this is. And it should be obvious by this point, sometimes we are groping for solutions as much as anybody. So if you have further ideas or insights to share, we always welcome that feedback.
Absolutely. Please do. Constructive feedback is great, as well as your opinion of the show or the book or anything else. At ScareCon, the one that's June 7th, 8th, and 9th. Last year, myself and Mike interviewed a number of celebrities in some of the panels. We were actually the panel runners for a couple. So Mike did Elvira, and then Mike did Blake Lively's brother. I forget his first name.
Jason Lively.
Thank you. Oh, I forgot
his name. Also did David Naughton from American Werewolf in London, and Doug Bradley from Hellraiser. And I'm blanking on the name of the kid from The Shining.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the guy that played Danny from The Shining.
Right.
And then we interviewed on a panel, the director's panel, where we interviewed Garo Nagosian of the
Dangerous People.
Dangerous People. And then the director and star of what's that drug? Dope, the name of the movie, 411 Massacre or something like that. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, 420 Massacre.
420 Massacre, exactly. So, yeah, so there was a lot of good panels that were there that me and Mike were able to do. So even if we don't do the panels at Scares at Care, we were doing them at Scare a Con. So that's another way you can see us at that convention too. And then we can always have a ad hoc meetup at any of the conventions where we discuss searching for American Gods, Game of Thrones, or whatnot too. So, all right. So, anything else, Mike, or you good?
I'm good. I think that I'm done.
All right. So, why don't you lead us out?
All right. So thank you once again for listening to Searching for American Gods. Please search us for us at the Facebook group or drop us a line at darkdiscussions@AOL.com. You can hear us also this week on the Dark Discussions podcast, and we're going to be discussing No Country for Old Men. And you can, of course, listen to us on You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, as we discuss the first and soon second episodes of its final seasons. We will be back next week to discuss Season 2, Episode 7 of American Gods, and we hope to hear from you before then.